A lot of it comes from experience. So what I found, if I think I'm being aware, but I've been switching off, then the patterns will just be repeating themselves again and again, that something in me will say, what am I doing? You know, what? Why does this pattern keep coming up in the same powerful way? And that will be, that doubt will be very helpful, because it'll be saying something to me that my practice is somehow, the awareness isn't full yet. And then that will make me, when, you know, then the suggestion I'll tend to make to myself is, okay, you've got to investigate this more. And investigation is one of the factors of enlightenment. Investigation being not so much a intellectual prodding of something, but rather like kind of bringing it up closer to the microscope, welcoming it more, seeing what does it feel like, what kind of thoughts are there, kind of going towards it more. Yeah? And that comes from just the natural doubt, this isn't working. So there's a willingness to enter into it more. And even though it might feel painful, the fact that it really doesn't seem to be working what one is doing, one goes into it more. But the going into it has to be without desire. That's the hard thing, without desire to get rid of it. And so the purity of intention is quite difficult. So I've always found the practice of metta bhavana, the practice of welcoming. You know, the classic story in the suttas is Indra is one of the deities in one of the higher realms, Deva realms, and Indra decides to do a tour of the other realms, goes here and there, and while Indra's on tour, Mara, or Satan was it? Mara goes and sits in Indra's seat. Now this is a no-no in the heavenly realms, and all the other heavenly realm beings, all the angels and so on, they begin to get really uptight. They start to yell and shout and scream, Mara, you can't sit there, that's Indra's seat. And of course Mara gets bigger. So each time the devas yell and scream and lose their heaven-like qualities, Mara gets bigger and bigger and smiling and just eating it up. Well, Indra eventually gets back and sees Mara sitting in Indra's seat. So Indra gets down and bows to Mara. And Mara's a bit, boy. And Mara gets a little bit smaller. And then Mara says to all the heavenly beings, feed. Indra, God, what a day. Indra says to all the heavenly beings, play music. Huh? Give Mara a massage or Reiki or something. feed him, give him sweets. And so Mara, so all the heavenly realms start to play music and treat Mara this beautiful way, and Mara gets smaller and smaller and disappears. So it's very much the negative states of mind. Quite often, you know, people that come to this kind of a place are very, very good, have very wholesome intentions, usually have quite a high idealism. And the problem that many of us face is that the reality of our karma is not is so far from our ideal sometimes. So the ideal is to be loving, and then one is in a rage. And that gets very confusing, because I really don't want to be an ugly old so-and-so, and yet I am right now. And so then you get the repressive attitudes, which we call vibhava tanha in Nepali. You get this attitude, I should not be like that. This is wrong. I am a bad person, etc., etc. And that's just feeding Mara. So any sense of self-identity is feeding Mara. And through that kind of struggle that this is wrong, I am a bad person, you eventually understand it's the craving to get rid of that is the problem, not the form of the mental state or whatever. That's not the problem. It's the craving to get rid of. And once that insight is there, then like real metta starts to click in. You say, okay, come, you can stay. Come, you know, have a massage or have a cup of fruit juice or whatever tomorrow. And then the power of that to delude is less and less. But that might take a long time. But if you continually are honest about your practice and you see things aren't ceasing, it's not working, or you're not confident, this something isn't working right, you just keep going back into it. And that going back into it is where insight arises. That's where edification takes place. Well, we say mindfulness is the path to the unconditioned. So my take on that would be that, you know, you begin, awareness is conjoined with a certain amount of ignorance, right? And a certain amount of confusion and a certain amount of self-identity, no matter how much we read about it. But as we take this position of being aware, being the witness, then what that actually implies in a deeper and deeper way, we begin to know that. And then the unconditioned becomes kind of revealed in that kind of a way. If, like in the Pali tradition, it says mindfulness is the path to the deathless. It doesn't say that mindfulness is the deathless. Right? Mindfulness is the path to the deathless. So it's conjoined with that pure knowing. And that's all I can say from my own practice. That when my mind, when attention is in that state of empty awareness, you know, I can't find any boundaries to it, I can't find any limits to it. But what I continue to discover is a more and more deep love within that. So that's where I tend to be working now, is the loving quality of that in that. And that becomes more and more profound. That's kind of where my exploration goes now. So if you just keep trusting in that and not try to take a position, philosophical position on that, because that's what we often, you know, where our doubts go, but more trust in that, you know, rather than figure it out, trust in that pure essence, see what happens, or investigate it. What is awareness? What are its boundaries? Yes, sir. Yeah. Well, my experience of that, you know, those insights come, right? And philosophically, I can understand it. But then what happens in day-to-day practice is that ego does just get in there. And it's so insidious, like let's say, like Mara. Even though I've had, you know, one has insights like that, and one philosophically has understood that, the insidious nature of self-view, not just the gross kind of, you know, I'm a great monk or I'm a bad monk, but the insidious nature of ditimana, self-conceits and all those, they're insidious. So one has to come back to that reflection of emptiness again and again, definitely. But it's my own experience, it's just that delusion deludes. So like when I began, and when we all began, no matter what insights we have or whatever, they're always tainted with delusion. I heard Ajahn Chah's teachings through a certain filter of delusion. Couldn't do that, you know, even though I didn't want to, just the inherent nature of the conditioned mind. So for me, say, in Thailand, they had this word toraman. Toraman means to torture. And in Thai tradition, which is a pretty kind of laid-back tradition, the forest monks tend to have this kind of really go-for-it attitude, which is good for Thai psyche. For my psyche, it was disastrous, you know, because I was already kind of, you know, hell-bent for enlightenment. And so I heard this word toraman. I said, yeah, you know, torture yourself. Great. And now Ajahn Chah wasn't saying that. He was saying something, but I didn't hear him. I heard what I wanted to hear. So I heard my own delusion. So that's the difficulty. Even though we can get kind of insight sometimes or philosophically understand it, still we get, you know, the delusion is that way. We get lost in it. But if we just stick with it, if you're willing just to stick with it and see, and watch it, then you break, you burst the bubble. You see, it is empty. Huh? In my experience, yes. Well, in the Pali language, we have tanha and chanda. Tanha is stupid desire, which is a nice way to put it. That's the way Venerable Buddha Dasa says, stupid desire. And that's desire based upon not understanding. Aspiration is, aspiration begins with a sense that I'm suffering and I want to go beyond suffering. or that there are enlightened beings, or that, you know, I'm a person that just expresses so much anger. I really don't want to be that way. I'd rather not be that. So there's some kind of aspiration towards goodness, be it very, very high, or just very ordinary about trying to be a better person. And the challenge comes, and the paradox comes, is that we are so used to using stupid desire to get our what we want, that it's a kind of struggle to understand right effort. And so the way tanha, and that's the Pali word, is defined is on one hand, it's the craving for sense experience, craving for certain kind of sense experience. So it's the craving for sense pleasure as a kind of attitude to life, which is going to prevent you from seeing that kind of inner dimension of freedom. Because as long as my attention is always desiring something outside, always looking around for sights and sounds and so on, I'll miss that which is always here. So that the Buddha talks about attachment to sense desire is not going to lead to the deepest kind of freedom. It might lead to temporary kinds of happinesses. So then believing that sense desire can lead to enlightenment is stupid desire. But knowing that sense desire can give you a bit of fun or comfort, and knowing its limitations, then you understand that kind of desire. So someone asked me, what do you want in your tea? I didn't say salt and pepper, I said honey. Because I like honey. Okay, so there's a desire there. But I know that enlightenment isn't a cup of tea. Some English people think differently, but this is... So that's one kind of desire. Then the other kind of desire is called bhava tanha. And bhava tanha is the desire to become. And that's very much based upon ego. And this is where you, in religious practice, especially practices from or religious philosophies from India, which talk about moksha or freedom or enlightenment, all those kinds of attitudes, it's very hard not to go for it and get it as an ego. Huh? And that is a struggle that most religious people, especially, say, monastics who have this kind of very high aspiration, they're trying to get enlightened all the time, which is a disaster. Because I can never be enlightened. Ego can never be enlightened. Huh? So you have this sense of me becoming something in time, bhava tanha, and the struggle with that, and seeing if I believe that freedom is somewhere in the future, and I do this little thing called meditation, or my little technique, or my little ritual, and then 3 years down the road, I'll be enlightened. That's bhava tanha, and that would be stupid desire. Okay, and then vibhava tanha, the third aspect, is the repressive. So that's the tendency to try to get rid of. So I feel anger. I'm a terrible person for having anger. Then I try to get rid of the anger. That's called vibhava tanha, And the practice is very much to understand those and not believe in them and not pursue them. So one's aspiration is defined in Buddhism through the end of suffering. And the end of suffering is realized through the abandonment of stupid desire. It's a very important question, actually, because it's this strange paradox in the religious life of a high aspiration, and yet you can't do it with desire. Think, how do you do this? And so you struggle and struggle. But that's why I think the genius of the Buddha's teaching, it is about suffering and non-suffering. And you can see that as soon as in this moment I want things to be other than they are, it's suffering. So if I can see that anger is simply the way it is, I can realize that anger is not suffering if I don't desire it to be different than it is. It's just that way. And that, so you get the peaceful coexistence with that. Good, a very important question, really, because it is a strange paradox you have in the religious life. Yes?
This talk about witness, my word for me is very nebulous. My mind wants to get a sort of anchor on it. Is witness already enlightened? What is witness?
Where is it? You can't, awareness, can you... Like awareness, you can't qualify it. You can't say it's like in London or in Scotland. You can't say it's male or female. You can't say it's young or old. You can't say it's got a quality. So the desire mind wants to know, you know, what is this awareness? And what we're saying is just let go, trust. And trust and faith are difficult attitudes to develop in Northern European cultures, I think, because Northern European cultures often, you know, they tend to be more figure it out cultures, sort it out, analyze it, fix it, peg it down kind of cultures. And but that would always just leave you at the level of thought. So if I give you a clever answer about the witness, and I just dazzled you with some beautiful array of words, you think, oh wow, you know, within 4 hours you'd say, what the hell was he talking about? You'd be back into doubt again, because that's the way the thinking mind is. So one of the kind of desires that you face in a spiritual life is the desire to know. And if your contemplation is desire, and you're willing to be with that sense of not knowing, then the need for intellectual answers dies, and a certain kind of desire dies, and doubt is seen in proper perspective. And it's very important for me as I've got a lot of intellectual training, and I love the intellect, you know, I love thought and so on. Some thoughts I love. I went through a phase in my practice where I just kept on trying to figure it out, you know. I'd read books and, you know, what is it? And what was it, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? What was it, 42 or something? How much?
43.
Sorry, 43. I've got some work to do. But then, you know, then my teacher would say, well, doubt is just a condition. And you, the problem is not that you don't know, it's that you want a mind which doesn't doubt. And that took a long time for me to see that. But now I'm much more clear. This is just doubt. This is just not knowing. And like I'll be teaching retreat maybe, a 10-day retreat, you know, and I'm kind of going into it and thinking, I don't know anything. This kind of feeling, you know. I could teach for 10 days. But now I can just, well, this is just the feeling of not having a clue. Which is very threatening when your rice is based upon, you know, kind of knowing something. But, and so on a technical level, I get fired probably. But I found that when I just allow myself to not know, I begin to see that which knows that you don't know is not an opinion. So what is it in me that knows that I don't know? And what is it in me that knows that I do know? What is confidence and lack of confidence are polar aspects of mind, aren't they? Doubt and surety. Now if I take my position with confidence, which is comfortable, then doubt's always going to plague me because I want the confidence. But if I begin to see confidence and non-confidence as simply aspects of conditioned mind, I find a freedom beyond confidence, and a confidence which is beyond polarities, you see. And this is where thought intellect and doubt are very important to understand, very important. And if the focus is on desire, you can. If the focus is on intellectual knowledge, you just keep reading and reading. And you found that when you get really, you know, you see really complex book and you read it, you just end up more confused. I found that, you know, I'd read some incredibly, you know, I thought, because my dad used to say, if you read more, you'll know more. Right? And so I'd get this really complex book, and I'd read it and read it and read it and read it and try to figure it out, and I just feel more confused. And then Ajahn Chah told me, don't read for 5 years. Thank you. You know, not that reading is bad, but reading with desire as opposed to reading with reflection. And so I found even my reading habits now, In Dhamma, I read for reflection, so I might just read a short piece, but then that might stay with me all week. So it becomes kind of contemplative use of intellect rather than just the sort of entertainment of the mind or that kind of thing. Okay. Well, yes, I can. say, for some reason, like where it starts, I don't know, but for some reason I was shy as a as a youngster, maybe because my parents are refugees, maybe because I was a mole in a past life, I don't know. But anyway, there it was, a certain, you know, so I can explain it in this life. I can say, you know, my family refugees, and I felt really out of place in a foreign culture, and so on and so forth. But whatever it is, I covered it up, that kind of fear, with various kinds of ego behavior and body language and all of that. And then finally I got myself into a monastery and began to have to look at what the conditioned mind was about. So that was a tendency which was like karmically developed over at least this lifetime. And because I had been somewhat lost in that tendency for many, many, many years, right, and then had developed strategies to cover that up, that meant that the unraveling of that wasn't going to happen overnight because there had been a lot of energy invested in it. Right? Other things, maybe, other kinds of habits which weren't, you know, there wasn't much invested. Like, I was never a cruel person. I've never been a cruel, you know, never, cruelty hasn't been my delusion this lifetime. So that's not been a problem. It's not been a karmic habit that has been indulged in this lifetime. So that, you know, if cruelty comes up, I was able to see that much more clearly. But say this particular one was very, very strong. So then, you know, it took one, first of all, I had to understand it. I had to understand the desire around it and all the things I did to avoid it or submerge it or distract it. And then I had to learn how to endure it in a way where it began to cease. I had to stop feeding it. And so that's been a process throughout these 25 years of understanding that energy, of working with it, and of allowing it to cease. So that's a very powerful one. Others are less powerful. And that way you don't have to think about past lives. You can, you know, I don't know. Yeah. I've never had any experiences of past lives, so I don't know. So if someone said it was from a past life, fine, but I still have to work with it. Someone says from this life, fine, I still have to work with it. So you still got your homework, either way. Okay? Anything else? Venerable Piyadasi, a very famous Sri Lankan monk, just died, I think 3 days ago. And he visited Amaravati, and when I was in New Zealand, he visited us there. Lovely monk. And he had lots of these lovely one-liners. And one of his one-liners was, "Trust in Dhamma and leave the rest to Kamma." And, you know, it's really stuck with me because what else can I trust in? I just trust in knowing the way things are and living, trying to live a good life and being responsible. But then what comes into that, you know, who chooses? It's just, you know, so if I get angry or I get upset or fearful, fine. That's just trust in Dhamma, leave the rest to Kamma. And then trusting in Dhamma is seeing this is not self, this will change, don't feed it, be patient, it will cease, those kinds of attitudes. So it's quite a good one-liner. All right? Yes? Disinterest, that kind of thing? Boredom. Well, if you use the same pattern, that whatever condition arises in consciousness, whatever mood of mind arises, the question I find helpful for myself is, what do I want that I don't have, or what do I don't want that I do have? Right? So it's around wanting, and it's around this moment rather than the future. So then, if you can make conscious, this is a feeling of boredom, okay? And say, what do I want? Yeah. But if that comes up and you can go to that and say, well, what do I want now? Or what do I not want? Then you're right on the point of the practice. And then if you can recognize that desire, which is a kind of itching and scratching, and just bear with the unfulfilled itching, bear with the kind of unfulfilled desire, then what boredom often takes you to is deep peace. Because if one just reacts to boredom, my experience of it, by doing things, then there's a kind of interest. Oh yeah, this is great. But it sets up a kind of cycle of boredom and restlessness. Yeah? And this is quite often in terms of like karmic habits. We're involved in these kinds of cycles. So boredom and restlessness. If the way I have dealt with boredom is by distracting all the time, right? And I just keep doing that, then I'm never peaceful. I keep needing to do something to get rid of the boredom. Then one day, lo and behold, either my senses aren't working, I'm sick, and I can't get rid of the boredom through distraction, or I'm just not interested in anything anymore. You know, the same books, the same old stuff, and I hit this kind of thing of boredom. That's actually a really good time for freedom. If I break the cycle. And breaking the cycle is very difficult because it's like breaking an addiction. And the model that is sometimes used in the suttas is a model of addiction. So if the junkie gets the person on junk gets their normality from the heroin, right? They feel normal when they have heroin. So the junkie takes the hit and then feels, oh, that feels good. And then maybe 15 minutes later, I've got to give up junk. This is a stupid habit. I've got no more family left. I've got no more veins left. And my family have disowned me. This is really bad. I've got to give it up. But the junkie makes that statement with the junk in the system. 2 hours later, the junkie says, that was a stupid decision, and takes another hit of heroin. And our things around, the habits that we face are very much around these kinds of addictive patterns. So with, say, boredom and restlessness, quite often, once you fulfill the boredom with some restlessness, you say, oh, I've got to sit with that boredom. You know, I'm just getting so restless. But that's when you've been satisfied a bit with the whatever you've distracted with, say. So you distract yourself and gosh, I'm not getting peaceful. I've got to sit with that boredom. And you sit down with the boredom and think, that was a stupid decision. And you distract the mind. This is what meditators do. You know, that people say, now this meditation is good stuff. It's really good for me. I think, yeah, I must learn how to practice meditation. I'm going to do it an hour every day. They sit down, 5 minutes. That was a stupid decision. I have to do the laundry or something, you know. And there's this addiction to do and become and be distracted. So to actually sit with unfulfilled desire, for the addict to sit and just feel the want, is the hard part of the spiritual life. But if one has seen these patterns of addiction, and one sees, no, this isn't really getting to where I want, there's a determination to forbear with unfulfilled desire. And if one can witness to craving, observe it, and be very patient, watch it cease, then you have a peace which isn't dependent on distraction. You've broken the cycle. And you have a different kind of a joy. You've broken the cycle. And the same applies to anger or fear, all these different things that we experience as human beings. So, but the focus is always on desire. If you can go to that and feel that and be with that and be patient with it, there's a chance to break the cycle. Say for me, like with fear again and shyness, the strategy was fear, was avoidance. You know, you feel like, let's say, if we say, well, next Sunday, I always joke this way, next Sunday, after this talk, or you didn't know, there's a price for this talk. You didn't know that, huh? We're going to pass a hat around, right? And there's going to be one ticket in the hat for the person who's going to give the talk next week, right? And then, oh! And then you start reading the books, and then most people wouldn't come. You know, I think I'll avoid, I'm sick, I've got the flu, right? So that's the way I dealt with fear. So that was the addiction. There was the fear, then there was the avoidance of the fear through distraction, through, you know, running away from it, basically. Then breaking the addiction was very hard because I had to now just sit with fear. And the desire pattern, addiction pattern, well, I don't want this. It's wrong, and all of it. But then seeing, oh, that's not working, the other way isn't working, just being with this, being with this, being with this, the addiction ends. But the craving, like an addict, the craving might go on for a long time, depending on the strength of the addiction. Does that make sense? Sort of. I've used that model a lot, actually. I found it very helpful. So there is this. This is where renunciation comes. Say, like, renunciation for me around, I experience a lot of boredom in Thailand. You know, I'd live a very, you know, traveled for 3 years, and all of a sudden I'm in this kind of very austere environment. So I experience a lot of boredom. And then the way the boredom, I distracted the boredom, I get angry at people. That was made me feel good. Just hated everyone. At least I felt alive. But basically I just had to watch this desire to do something, to entertain, and there was no easy way out of that. But then through the watching of that, the mind began to have some peace. Not through distraction, but through meditation more, through awareness more. Yeah, so I found it a helpful model. Well, good friends are very important. Spiritual friends are very, very important. So if you're hanging out with the wrong crowd, they're not going to help. Right? So there's a statement in the sutta where the Buddha asks Venerable Ananda, what proportion of the life is spiritual friendship? And Venerable Ananda says 50%. And the Buddha says, not so, it's 100%. So he really emphasized kalyanamitta, the sense of spiritual friendship, friends who are moral and who encourage that which is good. So if you make quite clear boundaries and determinations, this is very important, and then beings who are trying to draw you out of that, you'd be very wary and very careful. And beings who are being drawn out of that, you try to draw them back in. Then that would be the spirit of kalyanamitta, spiritual friends. But in the suttas it also says, the Buddha says, well, and if you can't find a spiritual friend, fare lonely as rhinoceros. Go it alone. You know, so on a social level, you do the best you can to try to create. That's why I became a monk, really, to have that kind of companionship and support in the spiritual life. Practice, the inner practice remains the same, but I think always it's important for communities and practitioners to keep developing right livelihood, right environment, right friendships, to keep slowly working on that so that the situation you're practicing is supportive. But if they chuck you in jail, you still, you know, it's the practice is the practice, still there. See, I've been very lucky that way. I've had very good teachers and very good friends that way. All right. Okay, thanks for your attention.